The massive data breach impacting more than 22 million current and former federal employees leaves many with more questions than answers. A recent Congressional Research Service report highlighted several of those unknowns that continue to plague this evolving situation. Dan Belair is president of the National Academy of Public Administration and a former deputy director at OPM. He joins me now to try to answer some of those questions. Dan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jason. How are you?
Well, we are here a few months since the big announcement that we learned about these data breaches. Do you feel like we know more today than we did a week ago, a month ago? Where do you think we stand?
Well, I think we definitely know more today about who's been impacted and what the information is. But as far as who's actually done it, I think that our government is remaining silent on this, I think, for a number of reasons, many of which we don't know. But the question isn't so much about as who did it, as to what we're going to do to mitigate the problems that this hack has caused and what we're going to do to prevent such hacks in the future. Because we know that this isn't going to be the first one, and it certainly won't be the last one, and we have to do everything that we can to prevent that kind of information from falling into the wrong kinds of hands.
Right. I mean, I heard Tony Scott, the federal CIO, talk several times over the last month and a half or so, and basically what I've heard from him is there's two kinds of people, those who have been hacked and know it, and those who have been hacked and don't know it. So I think given that premise, every agency is moving in a certain direction. What's interesting about this hack and what we learned about more and more is why did the whoever, whether it was a Chinese or somebody else, why did they take the data? Early on, the big theory was espionage. This was a part of a big espionage campaign. Do you think that theory still holds true today?
Everything that from what I'm reading certainly points to that it seemed to be more espionage-oriented than commercially-oriented. Now, that doesn't mean that it can change over time, but it seems that the information that has gotten out there is a treasure trove of information about individuals who hold very sensitive information regarding our government's operations. If you look at just the standard federal application, it asks for a number of pieces of information that can really provide a detailed profile of the individual, such as their name, address, social security number, employer's names, et cetera, like that, et cetera. So it does give you an idea of who they are, but if you go in, they're past supervisors, but if you go into the security clearance forms, you'll notice that it asks for far more detailed information. It's, you know, the amount of information that they request far exceeds that you'd apply for in a regular mortgage for your home. And it asks for things such as references, people who know you well, and their names and addresses. And that's what raises the specter of how they can utilize this and of how bad guys can utilize this and in what ways.
It's interesting. To get a mortgage, you got to give less information than to get a federal job or even a security clearance. From your perspective, from your years of experience both inside of government and watching government from the outside, you get a sense that that information is necessary. Does this change the way we as a community look at whether we need to collect all this data?
Well, you know, that's, I think, a very fundamental question that's going to need to be answered in the next few months as we, break down how this occurred and what the impact will be. You know, some advocates have long held that we classify way too much information. And by classifying all this information, you have to broaden the field of those who have access for it. So maybe this is something that we can look at in the future and say, not all this information needs to be classified, but actually those who need access to it could be narrowed in scope as well. But that still brings back the question of what happens if that information falls into the wrong hands and how we need to mitigate it and protect this.
And I know we could go down the path of a spear phishing and targeted phishing attacks in terms of the cyber worries, but there's also the other piece of it is the idea of blackmail has come up several times. And former federal officials I've talked to kind of laughed at that concept of whether blackmail is a real issue or not, because when you fill out your security clearance, you're telling them everything. You're opening the kimono, if you will, right?
Well, you hope you are.
You hope you are, at least.
And that's the issue, is that, in the past weeks we've heard about a breach of the adult website, Ashley Madison, which exposed names of people who were engaging in activities that they should not be engaging in. And if you start, for the problem to me, it would be, or the most significant damage could be obtained, is by cross-referencing these things of people's names who appear on the security list versus people whose names appear on these websites. And it's just not these adult websites. We heard about hacks into Blue Cross into the Anthem healthcare system. So all of a sudden, you have a list of employees who have healthcare issues that they otherwise wouldn't have made public. And how can you utilize that? Remember, espionage can take many different and subtle forms as well. And so this really puts at risk a number of people who may not have been as forthright, or even if they were forthright, they don't want this information made public.
So you bring up the next point, which is what can be done about this. And there's two things that are happening, I think, in parallel. Congress is really taking this seriously again, right? Again, we hear from them, we're going to pass legislation. And then on the other hand, just late last night, GSA and the Naval Sea Systems Command issued their RFQs for a new contract for credit monitoring and identity theft protection services, both for those immediate that need it, the 22 million plus, and then more of a long term, expecting more of these hacks to happen. Is this action, in your opinion, enough? I mean, will we see Congress eventually pass legislation that's going to be impactful?
I think, well, that's a good question, because you used the word impactful. Will they actually do something that can make a positive difference? I'm not sure yet. And I think that we need to have a discussion as to what those actions will be. But just yesterday, I came across an IG report from the Department of Labor that highlighted three significant deficiencies regarding labor's IT systems that regarded access controls, third-party oversight, and configuration management. This was part of their regular FSMA review. But this shows that these things are almost becoming routine in identifying problem areas. And I think that agencies have to be held accountable. I am glad to see that this cyber sprint that OMB reported on showed progress being made into how people can actually gain access into the systems, although you saw some significant backsliders on this, such as the Department of State and even the Department of Justice, in terms of having multi-factor access to the systems. So these are the kinds of things that have to become in place. It needs to become routine, but more importantly, they have to evolve over time if we're going to continue to outsmart those bad guys. Unfortunately, FSMA turned into a routine checking-the-box exercise when, in fact, it should have been much more robust. And I think that we need to go back and say, how can we improve that, and are there areas in legislation that need to be improved?
Now, you bring up a couple points there. The labor examples, I think, is a good one. So many times agencies get these bad reports, and people step back, and especially on Capitol Hill, which I think, you know, I find frustrating, and the fact is they step back and go, well, you didn't follow this, so therefore you are insecure, and you're opening the door, and anyone can walk in. And what I think also needs to happen, you talk about conversations and whether we look at whether how many people need security clearances and the types of questions that are asked. I think also the inspector general community, and I know they're going down this path to a certain extent, they have to also step back and say, are we asking the right questions about whether or not systems are indeed secure? Just because an agency, for instance, didn't do, you know, piece X, asset management control, it doesn't mean they're insecure. It just means that piece is not as good as it should be or needs to be. And I think that discussion doesn't happen enough. And I think that's where maybe Congress and OMB can play a bigger role.
Well, I look at this in the Department of Labor's IG pointed out three areas. Now, if I was, as an agency leader, I would have taken this and I would have said, thank you, I appreciate this, and let's document our progress on this. And that's what DOL has indicated, that they're addressing these deficiencies. But we need to take it one step further. With the OPM hack, we saw the same thing with the IG, identifying what are much more serious material weaknesses. But it seemed to just have, once they were identified, it kind of evaporated into the ether. So we need to develop a system where if these are identified, that agency leaders are held accountable for addressing these issues. Because if it's not a priority, then it won't receive the attention. And that's what I've heard from a number of IT folks across the government, is that FSMA wasn't the priority that it should have been. But there are other things that are priorities, and it wasn't that resources weren't devoted to it. So you have to go back and ask that question. How are we going to prioritize these preventions to these types of hacks that have occurred? And if it receives the senior departmental and agency leadership attention, it will be prioritized.
That's interesting you bring that up, because we could go down a whole big rabbit hole in terms of who holds them accountable. Is it Congress? Is it OMB? Is it both? And if it's OMB, why does this administration, and I know maybe we can't answer this question easily, continue to kind of rotate people through the deputy director for management? I mean, if you think about it, Dan, when you were with the Bush administration, Clay Johnson was the DDM basically for the entire 8 years, and he held a lot of power. So when there was a problem, whether it was IT or acquisition or whatever, you know, that person in OMB could say, well, let's talk to Clay. And Clay could then, you know, kind of bring the hammer down, because he's been there. He understands it. He was someone who was a known quantity. But with the shuffling that's been happening, you know, Beth Colbert held it for 15 or 16 months or so. Before her, there was this, you know, Steve Van Roekel, Danny Werfel. You know, there's been this in and out of people holding it, but no one permanently. And I think that's been a big detriment to getting agencies on board and holding them accountable for things like FISMA.
Well, continuity and leadership is really important, because you know the players then, and you know what the players expect. You know how you have to perform in order to work with these leaders. And when you have a constant rotation of leaders, it sends a mixed message that, you know, that they're no longer in charge so much as the departments and agencies, and then they have to go down there. They have to perform according to what their priorities will be. I would say with Beth that Beth exerted a very strong leadership. I've been very, very, very impressed with her. And I think that it was her actions in the last 13 to 15 months in her role at OMB that led the president to say, I need a really strong leader at OPM. Now, what, you know, will she stay there or will she come back? I don't think that the answer has been – I haven't seen the answer on that yet. But I think that overall this has to be a priority for the organization. And, you know, this is just not going to stop with the Obama administration. This is going to go on to the next administration. So this is one of the keys, I think, for the transition teams to look at, is how are we going to address these what have become longstanding issues through the leadership, and what kind of commitment are we going to make on the leadership's part to address and solve these issues?
I was waiting for the transition to come up. That's something that NAPA is working on specifically. I know that's something you guys have talked about with Tom and Francis on our other shows. So something to look forward to, some recommendations coming from you guys in the short term?
I think what you'll see is a number of thought leadership pieces coming forward from the Academy over the fall and through the spring of next year. What we want to do is work with the transition teams and not form policy for them, but provide the basic framework for them to make that kind of policy. And I think that these are just the kinds of areas that are ripe for that kind of discussion.
Dan Blair is the president of the National Academy of Public Administration. Dan, thank you very much.
I appreciate it.